morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's dot foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the Santa Fe Playhouse production of Kiss of the Spider Woman, and we're also going to be talking to Kate Buckley, author of a new book called Choices, and Heather Brewer of NARAL. Right now, by telephone, I would like to welcome R.D. Rosen. He's the author of the book A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West, published by the New Press. And he will be at Garcia Street Books tomorrow, June 22nd at 5 o'clock, reading and signing books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this book tells two related stories, one in the present and one in the 19th century. Let's start with the older story, the story of Charles and Marianne Goodnight. Who were they, and what was their relationship to the American buffalo?
Well, Charles Goodnight was a very prominent Texas rancher in the 19th century, also the inventor of the chuck wagon, I might add, although that plays no role in the story. He was a prominent rancher who, in the 1870s, along with his wife, noticed that 20 or 30 or 40 million buffalo were now just about all gone. And his wife had the very smart idea of saying, dear, why don't we rope out a couple orphan buffalo and start a herd of our own? If we don't, America will never know what a buffalo is. And because of what they did by design and what a few other people at the same time in the West did, pretty much by accident, we have buffalo today. So they began a herd in 1876 that by the time Charles Goodnight died in 1929 had reached about 250 or 300 head. And he gave some of those buffalo away, some to Yellowstone, some to the Taos Pueblo Indian, to seed other herds that are still flourishing today.
The story of the intentional extermination of the American buffalo is a shameful chapter in our country's history. Tell us about that. It had a long and just brutal history.
Well, it was a really bad time to be a buffalo in the 19th century. Foremost, I would say, because the buffalo was the basis for the entire Plains Indian civilization, as you know, most people out here. No, the Plains Indian depended on the animal for almost everything, from food, shelter, and fuel to weapons and utensils and art and bowstrings. And everybody knew that if you got rid of the buffalo, you were essentially getting rid of the Indians. And that's exactly what our white settler policy was. So that was one reason the buffalo's days were numbered, and there were a number of other ones. For instance, they finally figured out how to tan buffalo leather, which they hadn't previously. This is in the 1870s. And suddenly they were using buffalo hide to make belting leather to drive the machines of the Industrial Revolution, and that created a great market. Another bad thing was the invention of the sharpshooter, the sharps rifle, which could kill buffalo at several hundred yards very effectively. In fact, the Indians called it shoots today, kills tomorrow. There were other reasons. The Transcontinental Railroad created easy access, cheap transportation. You had to feed all those workers. So between one thing and another, between the end of the Civil War and about 1882, that's only about 17 years, we reduced the buffalo population from maybe 20 or 30 million to virtually zero. So without people like Charles Goodnight and his wife, literally, they would be extinct.
So let's shift to the present day right now. How did a little buffalo calf, a few days old, come to live in an adobe house in suburban Santa Fe?
Good question. Charles Goodnight has a great-great niece named Verl Goodnight, who until recently lived with her husband, Roger Brooks, in Santa Fe. Now, she's a pretty well-known Western artist. And when she learned only a few years ago, really, that Charles Goodnight and his wife had started a buffalo herd, she set about to create a large sculpture of Marianne Goodnight bottle feeding the first two bison calves in the 1870s. but she only works from nature. So she needed a baby bison. And they're not hard to find. I mean, they're not easy to find because buffalo make very good mothers. They rarely die in childbirth. They rarely abandon their buffalo. They have to be kind of separated accidentally or by force. And after a few months of waiting, she found a one-day-old baby bison. They flew up to Idaho, brought this little calf back, and named him Charlie after Charles Goodnight. And Charlie's job for the first couple months of his life was to model for the sculpture. But, of course, he was also imprinting on this middle-aged Santa Fe couple and spending most of the day in the house. He would sleep in the barn, but he became a house buffalo, at least for a while. And, you know, it was one of those rare animals who responded generally well to other people, to handling. And so for a while, he really was a buffalo in the house until he got a little older, and that's where the plot in the present thickens considerably.
Who knew that buffaloes made charming house pets? But this one did seem to.
Yeah, I think if you're a guy like Roger Brooks and Verl, you're animal lovers. You've rehabilitated a number of wild animals. You're good horse people. You already have your dogs and cats. There's something irresistible about the challenge of a bison, particularly if you have a good professional reason to have one. That is, you need a model.
Well, what happened next? I mean, the cute little buffalo calf grows up. It still thinks it's a house pet, and it weighs 400 pounds and growing day by day.
Well, you know, it's the predictable things happen. He starts accidentally wiping things off the tops of tables. He has a huge accident while sleeping on a sofa in Verl's study. I think most hilariously, when he's about 3 or 4 months old, Roger Goodnight and Roger Brooks and Verl Goodnight had some guests over, very prominent collectors of her art from Japan, and they were dying to meet Charlie because, of course, the whole idea of a buffalo in the house was unique. And so these Japanese investors, actually it was him and his mother, were sitting on the sofa, and Verl says, "Charlie, come in and meet our guests." And Charlie got very excited at the prospect of meeting them. And he was on a tile floor, and he starts, looks like a cartoon character. He starts spinning his legs furiously without going anywhere for a moment. Then he gets traction, and he starts heading for the guests on the sofa. So, in fact, he's charging them.
So they're sitting on the sofa, and a stampeding buffalo is coming at them across
the... A stampede of one teenage buffalo. But the collector and his mother did the right thing. Of course, they scattered. And mostly Verl was concerned not about the guests now, because they were hiding behind furniture. She was worried that Charlie was going to crash into the sofa, knock over the table behind it, on which there was an extremely valuable punch bowl. What happened, in fact, was that Charlie managed to come to a halt just in front of the sofa, which had nobody on it at this point. Then Charlie walked around the sofa and knocked the table over with the glass punch bowl, which shattered into 1,000 pieces. So it was things like this that gave Roger and Verl the idea that, you know, his days as a house buffalo were over.
Well, what happened to the animal then? They actually kept him, but he has a long story.
Well, they had never intended to keep him. They intended to raise him, get some good modeling out of him, and at the age of, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 months, when he became more difficult to handle, they were going to have him join a nearby herd, not the herd he came from originally, but a nearby herd managed by a friend of theirs. And the first night that they left him, not in the herd, they put him in a pen with two other teenage buffalo. And I always worry about giving too much away. Let's just say that Charlie, who really didn't know he was a buffalo, was not happy being put in a pen with two other buffalo, and ran and had a very serious accident. He hurt himself so badly that if you were not two people who dearly loved this animal, you would have had to put this animal down. But that is not the decision that Roger and Charlie made, and he came back to live with them under circumstances that would be overwhelming for anybody. But the love that, particularly Roger, who was madly in love with Charlie, the love he felt for him gave him a feeling of tremendous responsibility just to save his life. And so 130 years after Charles Goodnight had been one of the few people to save the whole species, Roger sets out to save a single buffalo.
We're talking to R.D. Rosen. The book is called A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West. What is the status of the American buffalo today?
Well, we now have, I think by some people's count, 300,000 or 400,000 head of buffalo. Ted Turner has 12,000 of them. A lot of those buffalo are raised for meat. Some are kind of trophy herds. There's only one continuously wild herd of buffalo in America, and that is in Yellowstone Park. Because in the 1870s, a few buffalo managed to escape notice somehow, and they hid in Yellowstone Park and weren't found until they were safe. They have turned into a herd of 3,000 or 4,000 in Yellowstone Park, and they are at the center of a huge controversy, which, if you look at it from a certain angle, is very disturbing because it's the first time since the 1870s that we are slaughtering buffalo unnecessarily and unjustifiably. And the slaughtering is being done by agents of the government, in this case, mostly Montana state government. And the story there is very complicated, but to put it in a few sentences, in the spring, a lot of the buffalo leave Yellowstone Park because they're looking for early spring grasses, because the pregnant cows are looking for a place to give birth. Once they leave Yellowstone Park, they, for complicated reasons, fall under the jurisdiction of the Montana Department of Livestock. These are not people who generally like buffalo. They're, you know, part of a whole tradition in this country of people who despise the buffalo because they were the enemy of the cattle industry, because buffalo are hard to control. And a lot of buffalo are being killed simply because they don't happen to know where the borders of Yellowstone Park are. And when they leave the west side, they end up in Montana. One of the justifications given for hazing these buffalo, for capturing them, for testing them, for slaughtering them, or for shooting them on site, is that buffalo are carriers of a disease called brucellosis, which scares everybody who is in the cattle industry and the cattle lobby. And they're scared because buffalo can give brucellosis to cattle. So it's important for them to keep buffalo away from cattle. Well, a couple problems with that argument. One is buffalo are nowhere near the cattle, even when they leave Yellowstone Park. But the real thing that gives the lie to this is that there's not a single recorded case of a buffalo giving brucellosis, this infectious disease, to a cattle. So it's a theoretical threat.
You know, it's a depressingly familiar American story. You nearly destroy something for the sake of commerce and self-interest. Then when it's almost gone, you romanticize it and form societies to save it without noticing the irony, and then you continue the destruction.
It almost feels sometimes like it's a kind of cultural memory of despising buffalo that has broken out again in that part of the country. It's a controversy in which both sides are very entrenched. One of the things that Charlie Buffalo, in the book, one of the gifts he gives to Roger, is that he turns Roger into a buffalo activist, and not somebody on the left who's willing to do anything to protect a buffalo. Roger understands the West. He sees that there's a need for somebody to mediate this struggle between the cattle people and the government on one side and the environmentalists and the preservationists and the activists on the other, because they're really not speaking to each other.
Well, there's much more to talk about, but our time is coming to an end. The book is called A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West, with lots of great pictures of Charlie the Buffalo. It's by R.D. Rosen, who will be tomorrow right here in Santa Fe at Garcia Street Books at 5 o'clock, reading and signing books. Thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
You're welcome. I might add really quickly, I'm going to be in Albuquerque tonight at Bookworks Books as well.
Oh, okay. We will see you there, or we'll see you tomorrow at Garcia Street.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Kiss of the Spider Woman. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Rachel Rogers Peck, who is the director of Kiss of the Spider Woman, and Angelo Jaramillo, who is an actor in this marvelous play, which opens tonight at the Santa Fe Playhouse with a gala champagne opening, and then runs Thursdays through Saturdays at 8 o'clock, and then Sundays at 2 o'clock through the 8th of July. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, this play is based on a novel by Argentine author Manuel Puig. Did he also write the play and the screenplay?
He wrote the screenplay. He wrote the play, not the screenplay.
And so this is the play that the exact version that you're using at the Santa Fe Playhouse.
Well, it's a translation.
Right.
But yeah, of his.
So set up the story for us.
Okay, it's two men in an Argentinian prison during the Dirty War, and they're two very different men. One of them is a drag queen, basically, a man who believes he's a woman. And the other one, played by Angelo, is a social revolutionary who's there for his political beliefs. So they're in there for very different reasons.
And it's set in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's a very interesting story because it sets up a dichotomy between these two incredibly different characters whose worlds, you know, in a lot of ways don't intersect. One of them is involved in the cold, hard realities of a political movement for which he's asked to and wants to sacrifice a great deal. And the other one is deeply romantic, a dreamer who lives in the world of film.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not, Wayne's character, Wayne, who's playing Melina, although he does live in this fantasy world, I mean, his life has hard truths as well. It's something,
exactly.
That's what you don't see at first, is that he uses that fantasy to cover up a lot of pain that he has and a lot of separation from the world because of he's different and not considered an acceptable member of society. And so, although they're approaching it different ways, they both are struggling with a lot of the same issues.
And the complexity of that makes for a very interesting drama.
It does.
Indeed, with my character in particular, I mean, he comes from the radical left of the Argentine political movement in the mid to late 70s against the military dictatorship that took over at the time, which was one of many. And I've found with this character that eventually he identifies with his counterpart there, Molina, because I think he sees that Molina kind of faces the same kind of persecution and believes that, you know, that it's a possibility that he could help him out with his personal struggle as far as trying to accomplish what Valentina is trying to accomplish in prison, which is hopefully get out one day, but it's also to continue to communicate with his comrades on the outside.
And this whole question of who your comrades are, I think Valentin doesn't see Molina as his comrade at the beginning.
No, not at all. Matter of fact, Valentin in the beginning is very still attached to the male kind of machismo type of attitude as far as being commanding respect as a leader, especially in the revolutionary movement where you're limited on resources. You kind of take on the kind of same attributes or the same, you use the same type of methods that your enemies use as far as being a military commander, because this is the type of activity and you have to be able to organize people and motivate them and get them to go. So it's a fine line between pursuing your ideals and dealing with that harsh pragmatic reality. And so when he treats Molina in certain derogatory ways sometimes, it's not like a full frontal, I'm homophobic and, you know, I hate you and stuff like that. It's more of like a complexity of who is this guy and what is he capable of and how is he as a human being, sizing it up as a man, but realizing as you go through the play that it's more about being a human.
Now, what did you do to prepare to play this character, Valentin? How did you get into it? How did you find the character and find yourself in him?
First, Rachel made me go on a fast for about 2.5 weeks. I could eat nothing but lettuce leaves and drink only half 8 ounce glasses of water.
And I locked you in a closet.
And she locked me in a closet and beat it with a bat.
So you could feel what it felt like to be in the closet in a small space. It filled two different...
But honestly, one of the first things I did was read this book called... It's by...
If only they had lettuce leaves in South American prison.
Yeah, for real. Actually, we got quite a cuisine going on in there. But I read this interesting book called Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number by Jacobo Timmerman, which was written in 1980. And he was actually the editor of a newspaper called La Opinion. And he started it, founder, head editor, journalist. And it's interesting because he was a political prisoner. He wasn't on the right or left. He was trying to make sense of the whole mess that was going on. But he spent like 3.5 years in an Argentine prison. And it gave me first the insight that I needed psychologically and to kind of have a feel of what it was like there. Personally, I grew a beard as much as I could. I did work out a lot to try and just kind of, you know, deprive myself of the luxury and comfort that we're so used to here, and getting fat and, you know, lazy and stuff like that. I have been working a little bit with dieting and a little bit of fasting, just to kind of feel what it's like to be deprived and hungry, and just reading a lot of Marxist literature.
Very interesting. Now, for you, Rachel, how did you go about preparing to direct these two men? I mean, it's an intense drama. The set is a prison cell with two beds, and right. It's pretty spare.
It is pretty spare, and I took on this show from another director. I didn't know if you knew that. Originally, I wasn't set to direct this. I was set to stage manage it last year. And so it kind of fell in my lap, but I had so many things that I really like, shows that I really like, had a lot of the qualities. It was a very small cast, so it was very intimate, and it was really about what was between them. I read some of the same stuff. I read a lot of the book itself, the original book, which is basically very similar to the play, but it's more in depth. It's also written in dialogue form, so it's very similar to the play. I did some research on the Dirty War and what was going on there. And then, you know, but you read the play a million times, but then when it really comes down to it, a director's job is to really take what you get from the people who show up on the first day of rehearsal. And, you know, as much preparation as I could do, I couldn't bring as much to this as Angela and Wayne, because they both brought their personalities. And so it was mostly about once they had come in and showed me what they have, using what they had to tell the story. And I was in luck because they both brought just so much. They both brought so much to the show. So
we're talking about the play Kiss of the Spider Woman, which opens tonight at the Santa Fe Playhouse. Who's the Spider Woman?
In the musical version, there's an actual Spider Woman. In this one, well, you'll have to come and see it.
But
a lot of people when I was auditioning it for it thought this was the musical, because there was a musical version written of it, which is very different. And so I actually had, you know, a couple of women show up for the Spider Woman role, and a couple of people who wanted to sing for me. And
right.
This is very funny. This is a different beast. So.
Well, this is the same, more or less the same play as was performed on film by William Hurt and Raul Julia.
It is. It's the same.
For which William Hurt, I think, won an Oscar.
He did. It's a lot closer than the musical. It was written. It wasn't written by Puig, but it was, very much based on the book. There are lots of differences when you put on a play, when you put on a movie, and with different characters and different actors. So it certainly isn't the movie. It's a very different show, and it's got a different feel to it. But that was the one that was closer based. Yeah, it was based on me.
Did you watch, or did either of you watch the film when preparing to do this play?
That's taboo in theater. That's one of the first lessons I learned, and I think Rachel has mentioned it too, that you never watch a screen adaptation of a theater project that you're about to embark on, because it can it'll just give you bad habits, it'll give you wrong images, and it's really about the artist's individual interpretation along with the collaboration.
And especially when, I mean, I did see the movie when it came out, which was 20 years ago,
right.
and it was brilliant, and I've always remembered it and known that it was, you know, Raul Julia and William Hurt, they were both brilliant in it. But because they were so brilliant, that's the last thing you want to do is rewatch something, because then you lose your own.
It's hard
own
to feel for it. Your own interpretation mm-hmm. of it. Interesting.
And especially the actors, they were not allowed to touch it. I didn't want them anywhere near it.
Isn't that funny?
So, yeah.
I heard a story about the making of that movie, which was a certain time into the filming, the director was having trouble getting what he wanted, and he had them switch roles. And it was so magical when Raul Julia played the Molina part,
yeah.
but they were too far into filming to actually make the switch. I don't even know if that's true, but.
I don't
I
know, but
so imagine
but it's
it.
Definitely a that's a technique that I actually almost made Angela and Wayne do that very same thing. It's definitely a thing that directors do, especially with a small cast show, because then you it's an interesting technique because a lot of new things can happen, and then you usually switch back,
but, right?
You know, because you've learned so much watching the other person about what they're seeing, and you know it's. And then you know what they're feeling more. It's a really interesting exercise. We didn't do it. I let them off the hook this time. They had enough lines to learn of their own without having to learn everybody else's.
Right, right. Now, did you cast the two of them?
I did. Again, like I said, the show was supposed to go up last year, and it didn't go up because of casting problems. After the fact, Wayne came in a year ago, and he had auditioned, and we had cast him and then tried to cast the other part and weren't able to. So Wayne has been on this show for over a year now. Angela came in about 3 months after, 3 weeks after we decided we weren't going to do the show last year. And so then he came again to auditions, which I believe were in February. Were they in February or January?
January.
They were in January. And so he came to a casting call, and we cast him out of that. So they've all been on this show. We've all been known who's on this show since February.
Did you put them together because of the chemistry between them? I mean, I think when you have a play that's two people, not
yeah.
only do they have to both be good actors, but they have to have some kind of chemistry with one another.
Yeah, and they do. And, you know, it's the two men in this play are so very different. And Angelo and Wayne are so very different. They're very different men. And so, but it's very obvious that these two, that both you and Wayne, Angelo and Wayne just really... There is a good connection between them, and that was definitely there, and it had to be there, because if it's not, the show just doesn't work. So that was definitely, you know, and plus they were both brilliant, so that's why they got cast.
And I saw part of the rehearsal. I didn't see the whole thing last night, but I saw a bunch of it, and the acting is really good. I was sitting in my seat riveted, ladies and gentlemen. And this is also part of the Gay Pride Week.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The Human Rights Alliance is actually co-sponsoring this production, and they've kind of made it kind of like their central piece in the whole artistic scene for Gay Pride Week. So they've been giving us a lot of attention, a lot of cuddling, and you know, tonight is the gala champagne, and they want everybody to come and meet us afterwards and drink champagne and eat strawberries and chocolate with us.
And more cuddling.
And more cuddling. Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Angela Jaramillo and Rachel Rogers Peck, actor and director from Kiss of the Spider Woman, which also stars Wayne Cote in the part of Molina. And the play opens tonight. It's the Gala Champagne opening Thursdays through Saturdays at 8 o'clock, Sundays at 2 p.m. through the 8th of July, and Sundays are Pay What You Wish. There's more information at santafeplayhouse.org, and the telephone number is 988-4262. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mary.
We are going to take another little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking about a novel about reproductive choices. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Kate Buckley. She's author of the novel Choices, and Heather Brewer is from NARAL. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank Hi. You. Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you. Kate, your book, Choices, is geared toward teenagers. It's about a 15-year-old girl in a Catholic school who gets date raped by an older boy, gets pregnant, and then has to go through the process of making decisions like telling her parents. What motivated you to write this book?
Actually, years ago, I was working as a screenwriter in L.A., and I read a story in the L.A. Times, little blurb about a woman bringing her 15-year-old into a clinic for an abortion, and the doctor recognized her and said, "Didn't I see you in that picket line last week?" And she said, this is different. This is my daughter. So that was the genesis.
Now, the picket line against abortion.
Yes, it was like I said, more than a decade ago, it was Operation Rescue. It was picketing this clinic pretty regularly in L.A.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, one wonders how many people, when their own daughter then gets pregnant, change their mind about choice.
That was my thought, and I, you know, wrote it up as a synopsis for a TV movie and pitched it all over town, and every woman I pitched it to said, wow, fabulous idea, but we can't do it.
For networks, political reasons?
Networks, yeah, won't touch it. This was a long time ago. So it's always been very, you know, testy subject, shall we say.
Now, it's written very much in the voice of this 15-year-old girl.
Yes.
And it feels very genuine. I mean, from the beginning where the cute boy talks to her for the first time and she turns red and is looking over her shoulder to see if he's really talking to her and so on through the whole thing. How did you get into that? I mean, did you sort of delve into yourself and your memories, or how did you get into that 15-year-old girl mindset?
Well, I have two kids. You know, my son is 16 and my daughter just graduated college. So and I also have worked in the middle schools here for 3 years doing a drug and alcohol abuse prevention program. So I've been around kids. Of course, you resource yourself as a writer.
Sure.
And I did go to Catholic school. But it was really her own story. You know, I got into the character.
I think it's really important to talk not only about the reproductive angle of the whole thing, but also how many women there are walking around I know numbers of them, whose first sexual experience is rape.
It's pretty incredible. The statistics, I don't know exactly what they are, but people don't really report it.
I think it's hard to know what they are.
People don't report it often, especially a young girl. And in this case, she didn't really realize she had been raped until she went to a therapist.
And that's another important point, is that she spent a lot of time blaming herself,
right,
protecting the boy who was a famous basketball star,
mm-hmm,
and not even wanting to think the R word.
Mm-mm.
Until she was given the space and permission to do so.
And even then she didn't want to think it. She was in denial about it.
And to find the well of emotions that's underneath it.
Exactly. The explosion. Yeah.
And all of this is in this highly readable book called Choices. What do you see, Heather? You're from NARAL. When teenagers are from Catholic families, conservative families, they get pregnant. What happens in the family dynamic?
Well, I think what we realize through this book and through families that are in those circumstances is this is an individual choice, and that no organization, no government, no policymaking organization can determine what is best for a woman, for a family, that families really need that space to make that decision. And that's what we're all about at NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico. That's what this book is about, the individual rights of families and individual women to make the decisions that are best for them.
What is the status of reproductive rights, abortion rights, birth control, RU 486, and all of this in New Mexico today?
You know, we have a lot of really good things going on for choice in New Mexico. There are laws in the state that require rape survivors to be provided with emergency contraception in the emergency room. Insurance companies are required to cover contraception.
Now, emergency contraception being the so-called morning after pill.
Exactly, exactly. Very different from a medication abortion, which is administered by a doctor. This is basically a high-dosage birth control pill that will prevent ovulation if there's been a failure in traditional contraception. So it's very easy to get. It's over-the-counter without a prescription. You simply go in and see your pharmacist, request it, and within 120 hours, ideally 72, but up to 120 hours after a contraceptive failure, emergency contraception can prevent ovulation and prevent an unintended pregnancy. It's an amazing tool that we have to help reduce the number of unintended pregnancies and the number of abortions. So in New Mexico, there are a lot of really good pieces coming together. The thing we have to keep in mind, though, is on the books in New Mexico, there is still a 1969 pre-Roe criminal abortion ban. It's never been taken off the books. It's unenforceable because of Roe v. Wade, but as we just saw with the Supreme Court on April 18th, they're not all that excited about keeping the protections of Roe v. Wade in place. So what we're trying to do in New Mexico is really raise awareness about this pre-Roe ban and to work on proactive legislation that codifies the protections of Roe here in New Mexico. So if Roe were to fall, we would be safe. Rights would be safe in New Mexico.
Tell us more about the most recent Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, on April 18th, the Supreme Court, in a narrow 5-4 margin, decided to uphold in its entirety the federal abortion ban. And this ban was a very narrowly tailored elimination of one particular medical procedure. And what really makes this an important and significant decision in the choice community is that the decision said you don't need a health exception in a restrictive abortion legislation. Traditionally, since Roe, every time that abortion rights have been restricted, there's been a provision except in the case of health for the mother. In this case, the Supreme Court said, nope, you don't need it. We just don't want this procedure at all.
And what was the procedure?
The procedure is called intact extraction and dilation. It's a very rare procedure that's used in only the most dire of circumstances where a woman's health is in jeopardy. So it's a key provision. That health care provision is key. The other thing that's very unique and alarming about the Supreme Court decision is the way that Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion. He's actually saying in there, women are not able to make decisions that are in their best interests, that the government needs to intervene to protect women from themselves and from making a mistake. That's turning back the clock at least 100 years on women's rights and women's autonomy. And we really need to remember elections matter. The way that the election turnouts impact the Supreme Court, the way that they impact laws in New Mexico, elections matter. And politics play a role in what happens in families like the one in Choices and in families all across New Mexico.
Under what circumstances is this particular medical procedure done? I mean, you say it's a rare procedure, but when does it happen? Mm-hmm. Under what circumstances?
When it happens is when a doctor and the patient make the decision that her health, the baby's health, are so severely jeopardized by the continuation of a pregnancy that there is no alternative. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends this procedure in a narrowly defined, limited number of circumstances, including women with certain issues arising from diabetes during pregnancy, that there are very limited but very real times when this procedure is necessary to protect the life and health of the mother. And what we can't afford to do as women, as New Mexicans, and as Americans is allow the Supreme Court to start playing doctor. We don't need politicians making our decisions. We need physicians making them.
And women themselves.
Exactly, exactly.
One of the things that comes out in this book, Kate Buckley, we're talking about the novel Choices, is that the young woman, the girl, teenage girl, 15 years old, in the book, gets information on her own, but she lives in a state, Colorado, where parental consent is required, and she's scared to get parental consent. She's scared to tell her parents.
Yes, yeah. And I think that happens often, and I think that it's not a good thing. I know it's been come up in front of the Congress here, right?
Well, the legislature here has consistently rejected parental notification legislation.
It comes up every year.
Because it's a particularly dangerous piece of legislation. Ostensibly, it sounds great, right?
Yeah.
We all want girls to be safe and protected and to have loving families that support them. The problem is, girls like the girl in Choices that do have loving and supportive families are going to talk to their parents. It's the girl who's the victim of incest. It's the girl who is trapped in a home fraught with domestic violence that can't talk to her parents.
Right.
And that's where parental notification laws actually hurt the very girls they say they're trying to protect.
Right. And where a girl waits too long.
Exactly.
And then she has no choice.
And I think another point that is made is that there is the temptation for girls when they don't feel like they have, or they don't have choices, or they don't have supportive parents, to go over the internet to somehow get their
yes.
hands on this drug
which can be very dangerous.
Yeah, whether it be the morning after or RU486 or something else, and not do it under the supervision of a clinical doctor. Yeah.
Emergency contraception is actually a very safe. It's actually a lot less dangerous than.
Oh, that's right. That's the one that's available over the counter.
RU486 is not available except through a doctor's supervision. You could not, in this country, get that medication and conduct a medication abortion on yourself. It must be done under the strict supervision of a physician. It's an enormously safe procedure and can be done very early on in a pregnancy, but it is not something where we have to worry about girls, you know, doing something at home on their own. It's done under the strict supervision of a healthcare provider.
And at the same time, the girl is going, maybe I can get somebody else's parent to give me parental consent.
Yes. Of course, there is a law against that now.
In New Mexico, we have no parental consent.
No, but there is a law against helping a girl, if you're not her parent, to get an abortion.
There was a federal effort to pass that legislation, but fortunately that did not move forward.
Didn't get passed. Oh, good.
Now, what kind of resources are available in the schools, public and private schools, for girls to even talk about their own sexuality, reproductive status, abortion, birth control, and all those things?
Well, you can speak to direct experience, Kate, but what we see around the state is there aren't any.
There's nothing.
Yeah, we even have a lot of communities in the state that use abstinence-only education. In Doñana County at Las Cruces, abstinence-only education has been the rule of the land, and now they're seeing the highest increase in the rates of unintended teen pregnancies in the state.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the result of abstinence-only education is actually more
a greater
pregnancy.
Number of
absolutely,
pregnancies.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't ignore biology, and what we have to do is empower young girls and boys to make the full range of choices. If they make the decision to be sexually active, they need to be able to make that decision safely. If they decide not to be sexually active, they need to understand what all of the full range of options are. And that's what we work on at NARAL. We're part of an organization, New Mexicans for Responsible Sexuality Education. All young people need to have all of the options and all the opportunities available to them.
And the knowledge of what those options are.
Yes.
Which a lot of girls don't have.
And by the way, there's a book signing and tea today at 2 o'clock at the clubhouse at Quail Run, where Kate Buckley will be signing this book, Choices, and talking about it. And you will be there, and NARAL will be there.
Absolutely.
As well. What kind of traction does the anti-choice, the so-called pro-life movement, have in the country and in New Mexico today?
You know, it's very interesting because the majority of Americans and the majority of New Mexicans are pro-choice. Fundamentally, people believe very strongly that important life decisions, decisions on when and how and how many children to bear, are individual decisions. The majority of New Mexicans are pro-choice. That being said, there's a vocal minority that works very hard to try and stir the pot and mix things up. To date, they have not been successful, and we continue to enjoy the strong support of a pro-choice state with pro-choice leadership.
And what about in the United States overall?
Same thing. Majority of Americans are pro-choice. The Congress is pro-choice. The Senate is almost there. We're like one vote away in the U.S. Senate from really being pro-choice. The White House is the big issue right now. And as we can see from the president's popularity ratings, although there are a lot of issues that are factoring into that, he truly is not reflecting the views of Americans. And the majority of Americans are pro-choice.
This novel, Choices, is geared toward teenage girls and boys, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Are you using it or plan to use it as a teaching tool, as a stimulator for discussion?
Yeah, I've gotten it to a number of school counselors here and in other states, and they're all very interested in it. And I've offered to come and do focus groups there. I've gotten it into a few school libraries. It's in our Santa Fe library. It's going to be in all three branches of our library. And yeah, it's also getting to therapists, because it's a very healing book.
Have you talked to teenagers who've read it?
Yes. Yeah, I've gotten one teen to review it. All of them have loved it, really found it to be a gripping page-turner.
It is a page-turner even for people well beyond our teenage years, ladies and gentlemen, because it's so easy to identify with each of the characters in the book.
Well, I've had a lot of, I even have a few male readers, grown-ups, who have daughters, you know, say this was very engaging. I really think this is a primer for, you know, reproductive issues for parents and teens alike. I mean, really have enjoyed the book.
How many calls do you get? Do you get calls every day from teenage girls?
You know, the majority of calls that we get are not from teenage girls, to be perfectly honest with you. We have a toll-free number, 877-CHOOSE, here in New Mexico that women can call to get the information that they need about getting the services that they need, whether it's a referral to an adoption agency or a referral to an abortion provider. And I would say 7 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10, the woman on the other end of the line, I can hear the other children in the background. This is a mother. This is a woman who wants to be a mother, who wants to take care of her children, and needs to be able to determine when and how many children she has in her life for her benefit, for her family's benefit.
And what about, I mean, New Mexico has a very strong Catholic influence. Where is the Catholic Church and where are Catholics?
I think that the Catholic Church obviously has a very strong set of opinions, but New Mexicans are very independent people, and there are many, many New Mexicans who have no problem reconciling being Catholic with being pro-choice, that there are a breadth of rights and beliefs and moral values that New Mexicans hold and that help support them in believing that a woman has the right to control her own body.
Where is this book available, the book Choices?
Right now it's available at Collected Works and I believe in Garcia Street Books. I'm trying to get it into local Borders, but it takes weeks and weeks. And of course on the internet.
And so the novel is called Choices by Kate Buckley. And once again, there will be a book signing and a tea today at 2 o'clock at the clubhouse at Quail Run. You will be signing this book. Narelle will be there giving out information.
Absolutely.
And all of that today right here in Santa Fe. For more information, you can call 243-4443. And you also gave the number, the toll-free number?
877-3-CHOOSE.
877-3-CHOOSE. Okay. Well, Kate Buckley, thank you so much for being with us, author of the book Choices, and Heather Brewer from NARAL. Once again, the number over there is 243-4443. That's an Albuquerque number?
Yes.
You have to dial 505. Thanks so much for joining us here.
Thank
on
you.
KSLR.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Clifford Brown. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, as always, because it's Friday, and much, much more. We'll be talking about the Human Rights Alliance, Gay Pride, and all sorts of other good things. So stay tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Ciao. Thank you.